Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to Let's Talk, the show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. It's time in the week that we look back at the media and the stories in the media, have a sense of what's going on in the world. And I'm very happy to have Zurairi AR, who is assistant editor at the Malay Mail, as well as Terence Fernandez, media consultant, formerly with the Malay Mail. He was the managing editor there, and now a columnist with The Star. Thank you, guys, for being on the show. Let's start with The Wall Street Journal's big story about China, you know, offering to bail out the Najib administration over the 1MDB scandal. Now, big story, and of course, many implications. One, of course, is for the media. Why is foreign media continuing to scoop us, especially in the post-May 9th era, continue to scoop us on the 1MDB story? What do you think?
Well, this has evolved, Sharad. Firstly, thanks for having us. This has evolved from being a Malaysian story to a global story. And we cannot stake claim to the story anymore because it has involved foreign financial institutions, it's involved foreign leaders, it's crossed boundaries already. Now, to say that Malaysian journalists, Malaysian media has been scooped by the foreign media, in a way it's true because it started off as being our story. But let's not forget that the very first organization, media organization, that questioned the existence of 1MDB was Focus Malaysia, way back in 2010, if I'm not mistaken, when they questioned what is this whole thing about, it's so clandestine, it's so quiet, no, there's no explanation about it. And I was in the media at that time, and we were constantly visited by the PR and comms team of 1MDB. They take us out for lunches, for Japanese lunches, and,
So you're a recipient of 1MDB?
I'm a recipient.
Ah, wow, okay. You might be investigated.
You better check the receipts.
Okay, so Ari, I could bring you in at this point in time. I mean, when you read something like this headline, it's because it's important in itself. You feel as a media practitioner, I feel like, I mean, a little bit of your pride dented as a Malaysian journalist?
Yeah, of course we do. But you have to remember that prior to May 9th, I mean, most of us were not even allowed to write or even publish anything on 1MDB. So we have that sort of like handicap there. So we have foreign organizations who have been working on the stories for so long, and obviously they have all the materials, they have all the context, so they have an advantage there compared to some of the local media, which has been in a way neutered. But you have to remember also that these foreign organizations, they have the leeway to pursue the 1MDB story precisely because they would face no consequence because they are just not based here. I mean, they have that privilege. Whereas, for example, Wall Street Journal, I mean, they may report excellently on Malaysia, but when it comes to reporting their own story in the US, they are pretty much neutered as the local media working on Malaysian stories.
So this is an interesting paradox that you can pass to have more freedom working on a story that doesn't have implications for you locally. Now, let's just look at the kind of global or transnational nature of the 1MDB story. We of course have organizations like the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists as well. You know, is it the future that journalists have to work cooperatively across countries, across international boundaries, in order to deal with these stories? Because they're just too big, the very big ones at least.
As corruption and governance issues, you know, cross boundaries, as you put it, yes. You know, we need to work together. I mean, in my experience also as a journalist, we did work with reporters from Australia, from Hong Kong, for instance, from the UK, to get information. But like what Zurairi said, you know, you get the information, yes, but what do you do with it when you're in Malaysia at that time? You know, publications were shut down, journalists were thrown into jail, and media owners were spooked. And then 1MDB, for example, became an untouchable entity. Like I was mentioning earlier, you know, all we got were expensive lunches in Japanese restaurants
by the
comms unit of 1MDB, but no questions were forthcoming. So it came to a point where we told them, look, this is a waste of time. You know, if you're not going to get any more answers from you, then, you know, let's not do this anymore.
Right. Okay, now we're in a kind of post-May 9th period, right? Najib Razak is no longer in power. We have a new government committed to fight corruption. Is the media stepping up, though? I mean, Zurairi, from your perspective, what do you see happening in your organization and other organizations that suggests that the media now says, we need to put the resources behind this kind of work.
Yeah, I think resource is definitely still holds the number one challenge facing a lot of media outfits, especially smaller ones such as us. You just do not have the resource to just let one reporter to just work on one story for such a long period. What more, the whole team. So that's definitely one of the things that you have to think about. I think the future when it comes to investigative journalism is the media pooling our resources. We've been seeing a couple of our own local organizations collaborating with foreign news organizations. But perhaps the next step is to have local intra-country collaboration. So between, for example, Malimian and Malaysia Kini, maybe with Free Malaysia Today,
okay,
working together.
Yeah, but okay, yeah. So this would be interesting though, because most media organizations view other media organizations as competitors.
Competitors, exactly. Right? That is another problem.
So yes. Would it be possible? Do you think it's realistic, Terence?
You see, whether it's realistic, no. to put it bluntly, no. Media organizations, for example, an English media organization would maybe be more comfortable working together with a Malay organization or non-English entity. For example, when I was running the Malay Mail, for instance, we did collaborations with Malaysia Kini online because we were not allowed we didn't have the resources to carry the kind of stories that Malaysia Kini carried. We paired up with Michael Osei to find out what's happening in the Indian community. We paired up with Sina Harian and with Oriental Daily, for instance. And so that was as far as collaboration went in terms of relying on each other's resources. Globally, a very good example of how investigative journalists pool their resources together was the Panama Papers. We're talking about over 100 journalists from 60 countries.
And that involved the consortium, didn't it?
Involved the consortium. Everybody who's anybody was listed in those thousands and thousands of pages of dossier. And yes, that is the way to go. If we are really interested pushing forward, reforming journalism in this country and how we go about doing our work, especially under this new era of Malaysia Baru, then yes, we probably need to stop looking at each other as competitors and see how we can pull our resources together. And don't forget also that it is this time... the media organizations are not doing very well financially also. Yeah.
Right. I mean, is there any chance of consolidation in the media landscape? Do you think that might help bring about some sort of economies of scale or some, synergies?
I think perhaps we can, I wouldn't say shift the responsibility, but perhaps we can, instead of just having the media organizations pulling their resources together, we can also bring around civil societies, non-profits, to help out. So when it comes to certain stories, for example, let's just say the most recent story was about our maritime and air dispute, right? So when it comes to such national security, national interest, maybe we can have not just organizations working together, but also, let's say, Wisma Putra, think tanks, for example.
Right, okay. These are some ways of sort of getting a story out. Okay, we'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. This is a show about the media and what's happened to the media over the week. We're looking at some of the biggest stories, including the one about the Wall Street Journal, revealing some of the negotiations between China, the People's Republic of China, and the Malaysian government during the period of Najib Razak's administration. We'll talk about the implications of that story in terms of investigative work, resources, clearly a big issue. But Terence, you used to work with Nadeswaran, The Sun, and you have this long history of doing quite a kind of forensic journalism or forensic work when it comes to local government, for instance. Yeah. A lot of things can be unearthed when journalists just put their mind to it. Isn't that true?
That is true. Any journalist worth his salt, we're having this discussion about, what is investigative journalism and, how do we do it, but, any journalist worth his salt, should just learn how to dig and dig deeper and have that, and have the will to do it. It's not very sexy, you know. It's very cumbersome, you know. It's very tiring, you know. And you're poring over. There's nothing glamorous about going through tons of documents, pages and pages of documents, or being visited by the cops, and having your statements taken. We at the Sun.
What period was this?
This was between 2006 to whenever I left in 2011. So, you know, we thrived on exposés, and we focused on bread and butter issues. So we narrowed it down to, because of our lack of resources, like what we discussed earlier, we narrowed it down to local councils, state government. But of course, once in a while, you know, we get a big scoop lands on our labs, like PKFZ, for instance, Payendah Wetlands. But we thrived because our organization, the people behind the organization, the bosses, they encouraged it. In fact, they called Nadez and me and said, "Look, I want you to set up an investigative unit, and we'll give you all the resources. All you need to do is make sure that you get your facts right, and we'll back you up." So they gave us the resources, they gave us the training. You know, they sent us to London once a year for a summer school at City University of London, which is the only university in the UK that actually offers a degree in investigative journalism.
Oh, wow.
And it was set up by the late Gavin McFadden, who was a director of WikiLeaks. And so we had training from and lectures from the likes of Julian Assange, investigative journalists from Daily Mail, BBC.
Right. So this, so you're saying the support of the media owners. Do you find that in your experience in the media, Zuhairi, that you've had that kind of support coming from upstairs, the bosses?
Yeah. When it comes to our organisation, right, the way that we do stories is not necessarily from top to bottom. It also comes from bottom to up, where we encourage our reporters to pitch ideas on what stories that they are passionate, what they want to work on. It's less of pointing. You know, you do this, you do that. But at the same time, if I may ask a question, how long have you been working in journalism when you got the training on investigative journalism?
About 5-6 years.
So yeah. You'd already been a journalist for
yes,
6 years?
Yes, yes.
Here's the thing. Going to that, I mean, he already had 5 to 6 years of reporting. And nowadays, it's even hard to find someone who has been working that long, because usually, I mean, even now the pool is getting smaller and smaller, with the working in journalism not as profitable. More and more people are leaving journalism simply to do, for example, public relations, and with the recent reshuffle in government, some are even joining ministries as press secretaries and all that. So the pool is getting smaller and smaller. So in order to get someone who is experienced enough, someone who skilled enough to even be trained into investigative journalism, I think that's another topic that we have to tackle.
So you think that people actually do need a bit of experience, a maturity or a sense of the lay of the land, who the players in the country are, before they can embark on
It depends on what your passion is, number one, and number two, of course, you must have, you know, some measure of grey matter.
I think we all have grey matter.
to pursue it. But what is more important is that, I mean, your passion to pursue an issue or story doggedly, that will take you very far. But at the same time, we were very lucky because we had, like I said, we had bosses who backed us up. When the phone calls came, we never had to go to Putrajaya to face the Home Ministry. Our bosses went. One of them is Ho Ketat. He said, "You just do what you need to do. Just make sure you get your facts right. I'll face the music on your behalf." So we need bosses like that to back us up. And of course, and you cannot treat your investigative journalists as a commodity per se. Hey, this week you only gave me one story. Hey, this week no story. You know, it took us 1 month of investigations before the very first story on PKFZ saw print, for instance. But we were not pressured to deliver on a deadline until we got our facts right.
Right. Okay. So the question is, and that's a resource. Time is a resource,
yes.
Right? Because you're taking somebody
yes.
away from the production, filling up pages. Now, in the Philippines, the Philippine Center for Investigative Journalism, PCIJ. gives grants to journalists, right? Takes them out of their own organization, say, okay, here's 3 months to work on a story. And they get, and their KPIs are pretty tough, yeah. You know? But would that model work here, right? Do you think, I mean, would, even if the company itself didn't have to put out the money,
yeah.
but they had to give time off?
Yeah, that's the thing, time. I mean, even, you know, losing someone for 3 months is unthinkable. Even 2 weeks, I would say that. I mean, just losing someone 2 weeks going on a training, even that is, it would task outfit that is as small as us. So, yeah.
It's
very unlikely, but it depends on the resources again.
Okay.
But
so for example, right. So are we looking at basically as the big players are the ones, the big boys, as it were, are the ones most likely to be able to institutionalize investigative work within the organization? I mean,
yeah, but if they wish to, I guess. I mean, if that is their editorial stance, if that is what they want to be known as. But otherwise, if you are just looking to reap profit, readership, make sure that you are just staying afloat, you know, then we may not see that happen.
You know, look at Wall Street Journal, look at Bradley Hope and Tom Wright. They spent 3 years pursuing 1MDB, and they're given all the resources to fly to these offshore islands to investigate people, interview people, look at documents, and they were given the backing, the resources. I mean, then again, Wall Street Journal is, it's a formidable institution.
Okay, so tell me, for people who don't know, why would an organization do that? What does an organization get from, finally, because they're lucky enough that it turned out to be a good story, what would they get? I mean, they get the journalists get awards, you know, everybody gets a pat on the back. You probably have a very grateful, you know, developing nation and its population thing. Thank you so much, Wall Street Journal, for helping
us. And worshipping it.
And worshipping it as well. Yeah. But beyond that, does it do anything for the bottom line of that media organization? Do you think?
I have no idea because, frankly, we just do not have such an opportunity. But I guess I think most of it has to do with reputation, because when you work in journalism, reputation is worth its weight in gold. So having your name associated with such a story is just rewarding in itself. Right. But also in the case of Wall Street Journal, both the writers managed to get a book deal and get translations and even a movie deal. So
there was money eventually. I mean, you're lucky enough.
Oh, lucky enough, yes.
Because it doesn't all stories aren't as sexy or as productive or, you know, fertile a ground for that kind of association, right? But okay, I do want to, because I'm just wondering, in Malaysia, Bahrain, we're so hopeful for the country. If none of our media organizations, especially the well-resourced, the bigger ones, don't step up to the plate, what's going to happen? Are we going to have to rely on foreign media organizations to perhaps choose a Malaysian story that's of global consequence to pursue? Or are we going to sink back to the traditional practice we have in most organizations of just following politicians and occasionally picking up a story from an NGO or so on and so forth, or a whistleblower?
I see, it depends on the policies that are set by the in the newsroom. It's what you want for the story of the day. If you are in the business of chasing after everybody else's story and chasing after politicians, which seems to be the trend of the last couple of years, then...
And nothing has changed since May 9th.
Nothing has changed. Then, you know, you're not setting yourself apart from everybody else. In my experience with the Malay Mail previously and previously with The Sun, you know, the policy was that we'll put all the Putrajaya-friendly stories on page 2. Najib PM put on page 2. Okay, so we are appeasing Putrajaya, government policies, whatever they want to say, page 2, okay, put page 3 lah. But we want exclusive stories on page 1. So we work with the team to help churn out exclusive stories on page 1. And as far as the pickup was concerned during my time, according to the marketing team, it did work. It did work, and then you eventually, you know, they say, "Hey, what is being exposed in The Sun today? Let's make a beeline to the newsstand and pick up the paper." So
it can work,
definitely it will work. Okay. Content at the end of the day, that's what people want.
Right, content is king, and reputation is gold, says Zariri, and he's absolutely right. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Shahad Kutin, the show that brings you the most, I am with the show that brings you the most important news of the day, the most important conversations. I'm here with Terence Fernandez, who is a media consultant and also a columnist with The Star, and Zerairi AR, assistant news editor with The Malay Mail. And it's been a busy week for both of you. I know you, Zerai, because you write, and your writing's there for all of us to see. Now, because one of the big stories was the abdication of the king, the Agong, his majesty, who is the Sultan of Kelantan, right? But he had courted controversy from, I think, very early on last year, with the May 9th elections and the question of the investiture of the prime minister. What's happened since, really quite interesting, because we had that story from Sina Harian coming out on the wedding, right? The wedding, or the purported wedding at that point, of the now former Agong to a Russian individual. That was withdrawn, and then since then we've had a few stories trickling in and out with, again, foreign media covering the story in a way that the Malaysian media seemed a little careful about it. Careful is that word. Okay.
Yeah, we're cautious,
Now, there was, and in this information vacuum, many things have happened. Now, since the resignation and a Malay Mail story and the title of The Rise in Pro-Monarchy Vigilantism Following the Agong's Resignation. Now, Zerai, tell us about that. Why would you following this story?
Well, in just a few short days, it was only like 2 to 3 days since the resignation, we have already seen at least four individuals either resigning, getting sacked or suspended by the companies for comments made on social media that are deemed seditious, or allegedly offensive or insulting towards the monarchy. And at least three of them have so far been called for questioning by the police, which, I mean, in just a few days, you know. So we were thinking, I mean, it could be, it could point to some sort of like conspiracy of people trying, deliberately trying to get people arrested and getting sacked. And true enough, we found out about this Facebook page of a group of vigilantes who list down, they call them candidates of people that should be, whose citizenship should be revoked. And as of right now, I'm not sure, I haven't checked it today, but as of my writing, there have been 8 people who have been listed as candidates. So I guess
these are the targets.
Yeah,
targets.
That the group has set yes, up basically targets for either for followers of the page to either harass them, attack them, or just directly contact the employers in a bid to lobby for the employers to just sack them for making such comments.
Well, okay, so there's several parts of the story. One was the context in which all this happened, which is the information gap. The fact that the media wasn't able to report accurately about things. In fact, it's not impossible to...
But report at all.
Report at all, yeah. Right? Now, it's Malaysia Baru. We're supposed to be living in a very different media landscape. What's happening? Terence?
You see, I am all for the royal institution.
And you're from Kelantan too.
And that's my sultan, eh? And I'm very upset because, you know, we've had 2 agongs from sultan and yes. Neither one have been able to fulfill yes. To finish their term. You know, the grandfather of the current sultan passed away in office and now my sultan has to abdicate. Following the events of May 9th, on the night of May 9th, I think we saw how important the royal institution was in enabling and ensuring a smooth and bloodless transition of power. Okay, and so I am of the opinion that the royal institution has to be protected, even if it means it has to be protected from the rulers themselves. So there is nothing wrong in the rakyat and nothing seditious about the rakyat wanting to know about the activities of their sultans or their agong, okay? And if there is a possibility of the royal institution being brought to disrepute by members of the institution themselves, I think we have a right to point it out and to voice our concern. Having said that, the 4 individuals who are in question here did not articulate their concerns properly, they had hurled insults.
Okay, so we can talk about that because there's a development on the question of what constitutes an insult. But your position of protecting the institution,
yes.
In fact, from errant members of that institution,
yes.
is an argument that's put up by Zaid Ibrahim in his brilliant book, Ampun Tuanku. I think he makes exactly the same argument. Zuraya, how do you see it, that information gap, the cultural dimension of this? Because the pushback often comes from individuals claiming to be protecting it from a symbolic and cultural sense, right? This is the argument.
Yeah, I think when it comes to from a media perspective, it's very hard to run stories on the monarchy simply because it's just a very opaque organization. Even with so many rumors being thrown around on social media, you would not see media organizations publishing that story simply because we just could not get any verification. Whether even denying some rumors, you just cannot get that as easily. And sometimes it would only take a rather naughty report for the office to actually respond to that report.
Okay, this would be the office of the house, the royal house,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, what's interesting is that, you know, some months ago, Kadir Jassin had put out a statement talking about the expenditure, right? Okay, incurred by his Royal Highness, right? So, again, the media strayed away from it. He is the press advisor to the government. He's put this out, and then the media shrunk away. I mean, what's happening here? Is it that the media lacks a conviction or understanding of what it's doing when it, in fact, exposes or investigates an issue like, individuals within the royal...
I think there was a lot of debate going on in the newsroom about how to approach this particular topic. And I think the last thing anybody wanted to do was to be a conduit for any fight between the Prime Minister's office and the Royal Institution. And it was kind of naughty lah for you know, my former group editor at NST, our former group editor at NST, to do that. But I, of course, there was a reason to it. And today, I guess, you know, things are becoming a bit more clearer. I think it was meant to tell the people, to tell the rakyat that that there are issues with the Agong. There is a possibility that he may have been compromised by the previous government. His absence from the country on May 9th has created a lot of questions. But then again, these are all, at the same time, it is also not fair to the Agong, to the former Agong, and to the Royal Institution, because we are all talking about conjecture and we are making suggestions.
So
somebody should come out then. Clear the air.
Okay,
for all.
Right. So here he is again. The paradox of an information gap is not that you suppress the conversation. You just let the thousand conversations which are not based on evidence,
yes,
or clarifications proliferate. Right. That's the paradox of an authoritarian system. The logic of the previous dispensation was supposed to have changed. What do you think, Zuraya, is going to take? What is it going to take for us to actually change?
Well, the thing is, even though we have been changing in the, we have changed politically. Basically, the politics, the political pact coalition behind the government has changed, but most of other things have not. You know, even especially the Royal Institution. I mean, it's still the same members. They still have the same members, the same sultans. Up until then, we still had the same Agong. So nothing has changed. So we still have basically the same culture, the same way of handling things from the Barisan Nasional regime. So I think from the media, we would perhaps appreciate a more open attitude from the royal houses. For example, the Johor Sultan has been very open with his opinions and even response. The Sultan of Johor and his Crown Prince have been giving a lot of interviews. They are very vocal on social media. They are very, very much quotable. And it's very easy to write about them because they are quite open when it comes to what they feel and what they think about certain issues.
Right, but the danger, because some people point in that, is that they also politicize,
yes,
the royal,
exactly,
institution.
Exactly.
Okay, we'll have to hold that thought and we'll come back to it shortly. Stay tuned to Let's Talk. Hi, welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me is Zurairi AR, assistant news editor with the Malay Mail Online, and Terence Fernandez, who is a columnist with The Star and also a media consultant, former managing editor of the Malay Mail and veteran journalist. We'll come back to the piece in the Malay Mail that you wrote, Zurairi, about vigilantism. Interesting, because there was a word that I had never come across. And I always, so I love reading your piece works because I learn something every time. Now, doxing, D-O-X or I-N-G, doxing would be the verb. But it is about ferreting out information and using social media and whatever about an individual in order to target them. So it's often malicious in intent. Is that what doxing is? Well, tell us about the doxing.
Doxing is a term that has been used online, especially among I would say hackers, journalists, and activists. It comes from the word documents, so basically releasing documents in a way. And for me, I think it's a tool where you dig up relevant documents, especially private and personal ones, in order to identify someone. But I think increasingly, doxing has been used as a malicious tool. And in the case of this vigilantism, you have people digging up private information about someone from publicly available data online, you know, social media, your Facebook profiles, Instagram, photos, to identify someone in order to harass them, in order to target them, and in this case, get them arrested or sacked.
Okay, I want to ask you very quickly about the Facebook page that you mentioned earlier, in which these vigilantes actually identified individuals. Any of those individuals prominent?
Yeah, so far they are just random people, like you and me. It's not. It's harassment exactly because of that, because they have the privilege of being anonymous and protected behind a Facebook page, attacking someone more often than not from the minority ethnic groups. But there also have been Malay targets who just cannot defend themselves because they are just open in the public. So there is a power imbalance there. It's basically you are attacking someone from the top rather than going up, rather than punching.
Okay, so this goes back to the Kadir Jassin issue with regard to the former Agong. You know, in releasing those documents or information about expenditures, you know, that seemed quite extraordinary, I think, to the ordinary person, was he engaging, do you think, in doxing?
From what I understand, I mean, it's a very grey area, and we were having this discussion. I was being schooled by Zurairi in the waiting room just now. It is not doxing if you're a public figure. It is not doxing if it's Sharad Kutan, because everybody knows you. So if your personal data goes on social media, it's not doxing. It's probably harassment or whatever it is.
Trolling,
you see. So and we do that as journalists, don't we? I mean, we dig up documents. We find out personal data. We find out addresses. You know, but we use them for the public interest, you know.
But public interest is an important maybe framing device for us to understand a distinction between what is egregious and unfair and what is actually legitimate. Because let's use another example. You have the Eddie Rajang case, right? So this guy who harasses some poor supermarket, attendant worker, and then those who label him as racist then go out on all-out attack. And also, and I believe the minister or the deputy minister came out on this, using images of his children or family to attack him. Now, coming from, as it were, the good guys using this as a strategy.
Line,
But so was that in the public interest when they attacked Eddie Rajang's family?
No, of course not.
I do not believe so, and I think I mean I may have changed my view on doxing. You know? I mean it's a tool. Anti-racist people use it against racists using it against others who they deem insulting towards the status quo. Journalists use it for our stories. I guess the issue is here. How are you manipulating that tool, I guess? It can be a tool in investigative journalism. When Kadir Jassin did it, that is, I can probably say, that is also considered doxing against the former Agong and also his office. But you have to see the motivation behind why he did that. Yeah, and I think that's important as well, rather than just labeling something as doxing and leave it as it.
Right. So the tool is the tool. It's neutral. It's really it's in the intentions, the motivations, and the consequences.
It's just increasingly it's being used for malicious purposes.
Okay. So what would how do we change the terms of the debate? I mean, we're going to be looking at, say, for instance, that doxing is a tool because we don't have a Freedom of Information Act, because people can't get to the more important stuff. They have to find some other route. I mean, all institutions in this country, including the institution of the royals, ought to be transparent. I mean, after all, public monies are being used, right? I mean, do you think that in the near future we will be seeing a Freedom of Information Act or a change in the way information is controlled in this country, Terence?
I think under the new government, we are a bit more optimistic that this will happen. Although, you know, it's been 7 months and none of the repressive laws have come up for debate and repeal in parliament. But we'll give them a bit more time, you know, they have to fix the economy. And these repressive laws, at the end of the day, benefit the government of the day, don't they?
Well, they shouldn't. I mean, this is exactly,
you know,
what we were hoping.
That's why I'm getting it. So you need to look at the in Kari Jassin's case, the doxing of the young Dipertuan Agong was meant to what? To undermine him. And to send the message out that, you know, he's probably not the right fit to be the Agong. What is the intention of doing that? But to avoid all this unpleasantness, we need to have an environment where information is readily available. I mean, the FOI, I mean Penang and Selangor spearheaded it, but it's not so easy to get information. The information that you receive in Penang and Selangor can only be used for your cannot be shared with a third party.
So you can't, as a journalist, use that information.
I won't be able to.
You're part of some journalist associations. Are you with IOJ?
I'm a member, but I'm not in the board.
So is it important for journalists actually to kind of pressure the government to change the way the information system in the country operates?
Yes, but it's just that. I may sound a bit pessimistic here, but I think there are still a lot of laws that needs mending, and I just don't know whether the current government can finish it within its term, especially when facing a lot of political barriers and backlash. You just have to hope that they can last that long to at least repeal something and eventually continue their reform. There are still many, many, many laws that needs to be amended, that needs to be repealed, that and enacting a new law, we just don't know whether we have the time. And not just today, they were sort of like announcing that we need a stricter law, a new law maybe, to protect the monarchy.
There are groups pushing for that, and something that we should be talking about at some point in time. But we'll take a pause now and we'll be back with more. Stay tuned to Let's Talk. Hi, welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me is Zuhairi AR, assistant news editor with the Malay Mail, and also Terence Fernandez, columnist with The Star and a media consultant, another veteran journalist. We've been talking about all kinds of things. Doxing, a new word for me, and something I will try and put in my speech, one of my discussions, actually. No, over coffee. Let's talk about this other thing. This is the last story I want to focus on, which came out of Free Malaysia Today. It's called Anti-Mufti Protest in Perlis Over Fears of Salafism in Mass Sacking of Imams. That could have been the title. It's a very long title, but Salafism really kind of jumped out at me because it's a complex term, right? And it required understanding. But when I read the article, as much as I understood, a lot of it was unsaid, and there was insufficient context for me to understand why this was significant. It seemed very interesting. It was very tantalizing, and I've since been schooled in questions of the religion by an expert, and including explaining the relationship of Salafism to the four jurisprudential schools in Islam and so on and so forth. Now, Zuhairi, tell us about reporting on religion, whether it's Islam or Christianity, Buddhism, whatever it is in this country, is there, you think the media in this country is taking reporting on religion seriously as a subject in itself?
Yeah, I think when it comes to reporting on religion, in Malaysia, we tend to usually report on religious authorities and also oppression of religious minorities. I think it's usually in that context. In Malaysia, religion journalism is it's not exactly like a separate desk, unlike in other established countries, for example, United States, where religion journalism is actually a specific beat and you have someone just covering religious issues. I think when it comes to covering religion in Malaysia is that a lot of the stories lack context. So, for example, when you talk about Salafis, how many of those stories would actually explain what Salafism is? Even, for example, the religious minorities, the Ahmadis, for example, how many exactly explain that, I mean, what are the difference between Ahmadis and the Sunnis? And how many are actually portraying them as deviants rather than a legitimate minority group in under the Islam umbrella? So I think this is what is missing from the reporting, and it's mostly because a lot of reporters just we do not have the experience or rather the knowledge or context when it comes to different religion that we do not practice, that we are not brought up with.
In fact, people often don't know much about their own religion, but that's another issue. But as former managing editor, you know, a media organization, did you think of religion as something that needed a special focus or attention, whether it was Islam or Christianity? Christianity is very big in say, in Sarawak and Sabah, where, in fact, the social fabric is very much influenced by the operations of the various churches there. Did you feel that it was necessary editorially? I mean, was it newsworthy for you? Apart from the little controversies, that obviously controversies will attract the attention of everybody, but as something to be focused on and follow through in a sustained way?
Well, it was a conversation that we encourage in terms of interfaith dialogue and interfaith understanding. So that was how we approached it. I was always of the opinion that where religion is concerned, if you don't know much about that particular region, don't comment on it. Go back and do some homework. It's why we always go out and talk to experts and academics and religious scholars and to get their input on what this is about. The thing about discussing religion in Malaysia, especially when it comes to Islam, is that, and coming from a non-Muslim editorial team, for instance, you know, there's always this caveat that, you know, if you're a non-Muslim, you shouldn't be discussing about Islamic issues. That is a very flawed argument because we are living in a we are living under Muslim leadership, and where Islam is the official religion of the federation. And which means also a lot of policies are imbued with Islamic philosophies. Being brought up in Kelantan 20 years in the past, you know, I have no issues with that personally, because I have had the privilege of being on the receiving end of the goodness of Islam, of the charity of Islam. And a lot of and if you're talking about the negativity in Islam, it's not so much the Islam, but it's their followers, and we have the same problems in all other religions. Now, so the dialogue about Islam and Salafism or Wahhabism or whatever has to be focused on Islamic unity, Muslim unity, because the country relies on that. If the Muslims themselves are not united, you know, you're looking at, you know, very serious consequences for the country.
Okay, Zohri, so you're talking about it from a normative perspective, right? I mean, the thing about, and I want to ask you, Zohri, I know you explained to me that you are part of the International Association of Religion Journalists. Is it religion journalists? Or
yeah, religion journalists. Religion. So basically, journalists who report on religion, not religious journalists.
Okay, so that's a very important thing. So I had never heard of this organization. Tell us, what does it do? And What kind of different frames? The one that Terence suggested is one particular frame, but there are others, obviously, to understand religion as a phenomenon, isn't it?
So it's a network of journalists all over the world who writes about religion. So
and you're a member?
I'm a member, so you can apply to become one. And what it does is that you get regular updates on how other journalists, more veteran, seasoned journalists, when it comes to writing about religion, you get to see how they work. You can follow discussions on such stories, and they also hold regular conferences where you get people from across the region to talk about their challenges and how they can learn on how to write and report about religion better. I've been to one of these conferences recently in Indonesia, and I think one of the things that they stressed was the importance of peace journalism, which means that first you try to ensure that there are peace between the religion, but at the same time, you cannot marginalize those who are already oppressed. So religious minorities, you have to ensure that when you report it, you come at the perfect, at a proper perspective. I think for me personally, you just have, you need empathy and also in a way skepticism when you write about religion. Especially when it comes to empathy, it helps when you have a very diverse newsroom, so you can get perspectives. For example, if you are from a Muslim background and you want to write something about Christian, obviously you need someone from Christian to get a context, right?
Context.
Yeah, and at the same time, skepticism. When you write about a certain religion, especially the religion that you are brought up with, you have to ensure that you write without bias and that you are not putting the way how you feel about that religion or about other minority religion, how you feel about it.
And it could be a positive bias, it could be a negative bias, right? It could all be... No, look, we've run out of time, but this is a fascinating discussion. Perhaps we need a panel to talk about how we report on religion, you know, and do it better. Because as, you know, as Terence and I think, I take your point, that in the future, the country really depends on an interfaith dialogue and, in fact, dialogues within the community, the faith community, that is not also tearing itself apart. So if everybody is reasonably happy with and accept some diversity within their own ranks, we'll all be better off, it seems.
Of course, we should look at what unites us, the similarities.
Absolutely.
There are a lot.
Okay, the one thing that divides us is because we didn't get that one MDB Japanese
dinner.
Okay. Thank you again, guys, for being here. Wonderful. For joining me. I've been speaking to Zorairi AR, pleasure. Assistant news editor with the Malay Mail, and Terence Fernandez, columnist with The Star, and also a media consultant. This has been Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutan, only on Astro Wani.